Welcome to the Alcohol Debate Podcast. I'm your host, Tabin Ahmed, and I'm so thrilled you're here. If you're confused by seemingly contradictory information about alcohol, or you want to understand what's behind the explosion in alcohol-free drinks on the market, then this is the podcast for you. The alcohol debate isn't limited to our individual choices. It runs right through society at large. I'll be chatting with a wide range of experts to help separate myth from reality as we examine what booze does for us and what it does to us. So sit back and let's get stuck into the alcohol debate together. Well, hello and welcome to the very first episode of my new podcast, The Alcohol Debate. I'm Tabin and I'm so pleased you're here. So the aim of this podcast is to explore both sides of the arguments when it comes to alcohol. And some episodes, like today, I will be on my own. Other times I'm going to invite guests along, and they'll be kind of in the capacity of sort of expert witnesses, if you like. Now, I do want to say straight away that this is absolutely not an anti-booze crusade. I'm not in the business of trying to convince you that you must stop drinking alcohol. But what I do want to do is to kind of put both sides of the argument, if you like, so that you can have a more balanced view of what alcohol does for us and what it does to us, so that you can make your own mind up, really. And today, what I want to do is look at one of the most common things that we believe about alcohol, which is this idea that it relieves stress. And my aim is to give you a flavour today for the sort of approach that I'll be taking. I did debate about whether or not to start this podcast off by kind of telling my story, as it were. And I thought that actually was a bit arrogant. So I'll leave that till next time. I just want to give you a flavour of how we can approach things and look at things from more than one perspective. So, alcohol and stress. There's definitely a really, really widespread belief in society that alcohol helps us unwind and relax. That's one of the many, there are many, but it's one of the many jobs that we give alcohol to do. And if you're anything like me, I really didn't question it. I just believed it was true. And stress is pretty much inevitable, I think, in our modern life. And in a minute, I'll talk about what stress is and what it does in our bodies. But those stressful situations where we feel our heart racing a little bit, they come up a lot in modern life. But we can also kind of assume that things are stressful when they're really not that bad. And we kind of use that as an excuse for drinking. So let me give you some examples from my own life. Back in the going back as far as the mid-80s onwards, I worked in advertising agencies and I got into the habit of often, like several nights a week sometimes, going to the pub after work. And it was like let's unwind and kick up our heels at the end of the day. And we would be particularly likely to go to the pub if we'd had difficult client meetings. Or just a difficult time, we were grappling with something that was a bit hard, maybe some difficult negotiations with media owners or whatever. But going to the pub and having a few glasses of wine to unwind from the stressful situation that we were in was kind of a mindset, really. Actually, it wasn't that stressful, to be honest, but we could position it as such and therefore justify the drinking. A few years later, I was married and had two children. And we had a nanny and I would get home from work and take over from her and get the children to bed. And I do remember very clearly kind of, and I'm really not proud of this and it's a sadness to me, but I used to rush through bath and bedtime and stories and all of that in order to get downstairs, have my glass of wine so that I could, inverted commas, unwind. And that really, again, how stressful is it to look after two absolutely gorgeous, very easy children. It really wasn't that difficult. It wasn't that stressful. But I'd kind of persuaded myself that it was stressful so that I could justify my glass of wine. A few years later still, I was working. If I think, you know, even 10 years ago or whatever, I had a job and I would drive home from work and I was working quite a distance away. It would take me the best part of an hour to get home. And yes, there are pressures at work. Obviously, you know, it's not just a breeze all of the time. And I got into the sort of state of mind where I would put my bag down and just go straight to the fridge. Oh, I need a drink. I need that drink. I've got to unwind. And actually, yeah, of course, some days were difficult and things weren't going so well at work, or there was a problem with a particular client or their account or whatever, or maybe I'd had a bit of a run-in with somebody in the creative department. But in the greater scheme of things, it wasn't hugely stressful. I told myself that it was, and that that's why I needed that drink. And another time I would drink would be at the end of the day, when the children were still living at home and I was still married. I would get home and I was working a lot of the time, get home from work and then get straight into making the evening meal. Now, I actually love cooking. There is nothing stressful about cooking for me. I really, really enjoy it. But I would still do that thing of, oh, I need a drink. I need to unwind. Yeah, I've been at work all day and now I've got to make a meal. Again, it was my subconscious kind of telling me that this was stressful and therefore I needed the drink to unwind. Should I really, really stop and think about it? Possibly not quite so much. But there are times in life when we are under huge stress. I know that when I had some really big financial problems, I would get that sort of racing heart and feeling of kind of almost like palpitations. And I would turn to the wine bottle then. And in society, we do that, don't we? We will often give people some brandy to help deal with shock. If they've had some bad news, we'll have a drink to settle our nerves if there's something coming up. Not always a good idea, that one. If you're nervous before giving a speech or doing something, you know, sporting, alcohol may not be the best idea, but we'll often do it anyway, won't we? And actually, it's not so long ago since the Navy stopped giving sailors a daily tot of rum. And during wars and things, it's very common for soldiers and sailors and airmen to be having a little to pick me up before they go into battle. And it, again, it's helping overcome the nerves. Now, those nerves are natural. Of course, if you're going into battle, you're going to be frightened. But a little bit of alcohol is probably not a great idea in terms of, you know, if you're trying to, I don't know, I'm sure they don't when they're on a plane, flying a plane, but it can impair our judgment, as we know. So we're giving alcohol a job to do there that it's not really that good at. These are all examples of where we give alcohol the role of helping us to unwind and deal with stress. And as I said, not all of these are really genuinely stressful occasions. But I want to just dig into stress a bit more. What is it really? Well, strictly speaking, when we are stressed, it's when we're in that fight or flight mode. And actually, there's a third one, freeze. Fight, flight or freeze. And this is when we have a genuinely fearful reaction to some situation, and our body responds by releasing some chemicals, some hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, that are going to equip us to deal with that fearful situation. And it's called fight or flight because that's what the cortisol and adrenaline allow us to do, to either have extra strength so that we can fight off whatever physical threat we face, or extra speed so that we can flee that physical threat. Or if neither of those is going to work, we'll just freeze. We effectively play dead and hope that whatever it is that represents the physical threat may think that we're already dead and therefore leave us alone. So it's a very strong kind of primitive survival technique. It has a name, the fight or flight. It's called the sympathetic nervous system. And I always think that's a bit of a misnomer because actually there's not much sympathetic or nice about it. When we are genuinely stressed and exhibiting those physical symptoms of that fear, it's not particularly pleasant. The reality, though, is that in the modern era, we don't face that many genuine physical threats. Of course, it does happen. If you're walking alone at night and you hear footsteps behind you and you think somebody's following you, that instinct will kick in. That fearful response, the stressed response will kick in. If you go through a dark alley, of course, that's when your heightened state of alertness and fearful and listening to everything and ready at a moment's notice to climb a wall or run away or whatever. But most of the threats that we face these days are kind of mental and emotional threats. So the typical one would be, you know, a slightly stroppy or displeased email from your boss, that sort of thing. So when that happens, it's not such a great idea to respond physically. Running away from an email from a boss, as in kind of ignoring it, I guess, not a great idea. These things need to be dealt with. Equally, fighting the boss is probably not going to go down very well either. You don't want to get into fisticuffs with somebody over something they've said or done. So we face these mental and emotional threats that cause the same response, the same adrenaline, cortisol increases in our body. But actually, what we need is not the adrenaline and cortisol. It's something that will help us deal with the threat, the non-physical threat, in a kind of calm, logical way. So actually, ideally, we'd be looking for something that reduces the level of adrenaline and cortisol, not something that increases them. And what we'd want to do is to move from that fight or flight mode, the sympathetic nervous system, into the flip of that, which is the rest and digest nervous system, which is called the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, it follows that if we're about to be attacked by a wild animal, there's not much point being in the rest and digest mode. It kind of doesn't make much difference whether we've digested our supper if we're about to become somebody else's supper. It's irrelevant. Doesn't matter if we're well rested, if we're about to be toast. But if we're not, if the physical threat really isn't real, it's just mental, then we are much better off digesting our food and being rested and calm. At the moment, we tend to give that job to alcohol. We're saying to alcohol, okay, help me to relax, help me to rest, help me to achieve a de-stressed state of being. So the question is, can alcohol actually do that for us? And what I'm going to do now is to sort of try and explain what happens in the body when we drink alcohol. And I'm afraid I need to kind of get a little bit scientific and explain the processes. And so I'm going to name a few chemicals / hormones, but I'll try to keep it simple. So the reason why we like to drink is because we get a hit of dopamine from the alcohol. Dopamine is one of the pleasure hormones, and it's responsible for that 20-30 minute pleasurable buzz that we get when we drink alcohol. And anybody who's drunk knows what I'm talking about, I think. Now, the really interesting thing about dopamine is that once the brain realizes that with alcohol comes dopamine, the brain will actually start to release the dopamine in anticipation of having that drink. So what happens is that, and they did a really, really interesting experiment where they wired people up and sent them into a wine bar. And these people were all, they weren't sort of like serious problematic drinkers, but they enjoyed a drink. And they went into a wine bar, sat down, group of friends, and ordered a bottle of wine. And there was a spike of dopamine, first of all, just on going in, finding a table, and then again when they ordered the bottle of wine. And then the waiter brought them the glasses, another spike, more anticipation of the dopamine. And then a really big spike when he brought the wine and took the cork out. Now, up until that point, all of that dopamine in the body causes no kind of reaction in the body. It's just the pleasure. The scientists would refer to it as the euphoria. Dopamine is a good guy. It's not inherently bad for us at all. But, and there is a big but, once we drink the alcohol and it gets into our bloodstream, at that point, the body recognises that this dopamine isn't without consequence. It's a euphoria, but the euphoria is coming from the chemical and not just from anticipation. And the alcohol in the bloodstream leads the body to release a counter chemical, if you like, to the dopamine. That counter chemical is called dienorphin. And whereas dopamine is a pleasure-inducing euphoric hormone, dienorphin, which is released once the alcohol is in the bloodstream, dienorphin is a depressant, a dysphoric, and it's also a sedative. So as soon as the alcohol's in the bloodstream and the body kind of clocks what's going on, things start to go a bit wrong, really. The dopamine takes our mood up, and then the dienorphin, which is released to counteract it, takes our mood back down again. And in fact, it takes our mood a little bit lower than it was before. So we don't just get back to where we were. We feel a bit edgy and out of sorts. And we generally interpret that as, I could do with another drink. And so we have another drink. And the same thing happens again. We get the increase in mood, the improvement in mood, followed then by a decrease as the dienorphin kicks in. And time-wise, the kicker is that the dopamine hit lasts sort of 20 to 30 minutes until the dienorphin is released. But the dienorphin hangs around for 2 to 3 hours. So the long-term effect is to bring our mood down. And that's one of the reasons why we often find that people are kind of a bit drunk and maudlin when they drink. I remember very clearly, well, actually, that's a lie. I don't remember that clearly, but I do recall being in a nightclub in London after some work do, really very drunk. And I was very, very tearful. Just didn't really know why. I was just being miserable. I can now see that that was just a system that was flooded with dienorphin, with the depressant. And I've experienced the same at my daughter's wedding. One of her friends was very tearful at the end, and she said to me, oh, she was sort of like sobbing on my shoulder and saying, oh, Tabin, I don't know why I'm crying. It's been such a lovely day. Why am I so upset? And I was like, don't worry about it. I think I know, but we'll talk about it in the morning kind of thing. And that's just the dienorphin making us miserable. Now, I mentioned that dienorphin is a depressant, but also a sedative. The sedative effect, at its most extreme, leads to us just passing out, blacking out. That's happened to me once or twice, luckily not that many times, and nothing bad happened whilst I was blacked out, at least as far as I know. But we don't have to black out to experience elements of sedation. It manifests itself in all sorts of ways. Our senses are dulled. We are not able to speak properly. We slur. We're not balanced. We can't walk properly. In the olden days, before breathalyzers, it was one of the tests that the police did to see if somebody was drunk or not. Get them to walk in a straight line. If you can't walk in a straight line, you probably have had too much to drink. So that was how they told whether people were drunk. we're just uncoordinated. We bump into things. I'm sure I'm not the only person who's woken up with unexplained bruises from walking into things or tripping over. One of my fellow coaches, one of the things that made her realise she had a problem with alcohol was that she left a party, really quite drunk, and fell into a rose bush and had to go to either the doctor or the hospital to have all these rose thorns removed from her arms and legs. And the medical note said, pissed, fell in rose bush. And she said, really? I'm a mum now. This has got to stop. That was one of the things that triggered her. The other side of the sedation is that it kind of, it impairs our sensibilities. And that's not just physically, but also our kind of mental acuity, if you like, in that we make bad judgments. We say things that are ill-advised. We're insensitive to other people and other people's moods. And that's why often when we're drinking, we can upset people. And we kind of, we wake up and we haven't got very good memory of it. We just think, don't think it went too well last night, but I can't quite remember what I said or did. And especially if more than one person is drunk, two or more are drunk, that can really flare up quite easily. And it can lead to people becoming aggressive and to violence as well. I mentioned that the dianorphin takes the mood down and then we have another drink to take it back up, but we never quite get back to where we were before. This is one of the reasons why it can be very difficult to stop at one drink, because we're always trying to get back to where we were. Now, so far, I've explained the process of what happens when alcohol gets into our bloodstream. There's no mention of anything to do with stress so far. I've talked about feeling happy, the euphoria from the dopamine, and then feeling unhappy, the dysphoria from the dianorphin, and being sedated from the dianorphin. But there is more to the story. It doesn't stop with the release of dianorphin. What the body does, the body's always trying to get back into balance. And because it releases an excess of dianorphin, more dianorphin than is really needed to get us back into balance, the body then realises, hang on a minute, kind of overdone this sedation thing. And it releases adrenaline and cortisol. Effectively, the excess of dianorphin and the sedative effects of it triggers the adrenal gland. Kind of the body says, whoa, need to wake her up a bit. Now, that adrenaline and cortisol is typically released in the early hours of the morning when we should be sound asleep. Tends to be released 4 to 5 hours after drinking. So we're in bed, sound asleep, more likely just kind of passed out, the chemical cosh of alcohol rather than genuine good quality sleep. And then, boom. Adrenal gland is triggered, adrenaline, cortisol, and we wake up with that horrible feeling of a sort of almost panic, like heart racing. Oh, something bad's happening. What's going on? Oh. And often we can, certainly it's happened to me, that I almost sort of sit up and think, did I hear something? What's going on? And then it's that, you know, if you've been drinking, it's usually accompanied by that horrible sort of dry mouth feeling, quite often a headache as well, and dehydration, and the fear. And we have that expression, don't we? Hangxiety. And it's true. When we have been drinking, we wake up the next day at whatever time with feelings of being hungover to a greater or lesser extent, and the anxiety. So hence hangxiety. The anxiety, the stress, the racing heart, the sort of feeling of impending doom to a greater or lesser extent. Now, some of you may not get hangovers. There are two reasons for that. One, it may be that you really didn't drink very much. But the other thing is that the body does get used to alcohol, and hangovers can kind of become less of a thing. And or we're so used to them that we think that that's normal. We think that's how we feel every morning. There's a great expression, tired but wired, which is really good. Or is it wired but tired? Yeah, Wired but tired. I think that's the right way around, isn't it? That's what we would normally say. So we're wired, and that's from the adrenaline and cortisol. So we're kind of on edge, but we're also tired. We haven't actually slept that well. Now, I will do a whole episode on sleep, but alcohol is not good for our quality of sleep. One of the things that people say to me more often than anything else when they get alcohol free is, oh my God, I'm sleeping like a baby. Oh, can't believe how well I'm sleeping these days. So if you are drinking and thinking about maybe taking a break, that is one of the real benefits. Doesn't come straight away. And for some people, it takes a little while. But honestly, the quality of sleep without alcohol is so much better than when we're drinking. That's a slight aside, and we will come back to that. But that wired but tired feeling is for real, because the wired bit is coming from the adrenaline and the cortisol that are released as a result of drinking. And the tiredness is from the fact that the stress is there because of the alcohol and the adrenaline and the cortisol and waking us up early in the morning when we should really be sound asleep. And it's really hard to get back to sleep if your body is flooded with adrenaline and cortisol. You're on sort of hyper alert status, if you like, when you've been woken up like that. And it's really difficult to relax. So I hope that I've been able to just explain a little bit that the theory that alcohol helps us unwind at the end of the day doesn't really hold water when we look at the science. The reality is that far from relaxing us, alcohol will actually do the opposite. It will increase the levels of cortisol and adrenaline in our body, which are the fight or flight hormones, which are completely contradictory to relaxation. So if alcohol can't do that job, what can? Well, I'm going to come back to that in future episodes. There are a host of things that we can try. It's different horses for different courses, really, because not everybody likes everything. But there are numerous different things we can try in order to properly relax rather than use a chemical to try and do the job for us and do it fairly ineffectively. And in future episodes, I'll also look at what you can do to change your drinking habits if you feel that you might want to take a break from booze for a bit. Absolutely no compunction, no compulsion to do so. But if you are curious about how it can make a difference, maybe you want to taste some better sleep, then we'll be talking about tips and tactics. What I would say for the moment is when you have that thought of, oh, I need to drink to unwind, just stop and ask yourself what you're unwinding from. And are you genuinely stressed, or is your subconscious just putting that forward as kind of like an excuse for having a drink? So I hope you've enjoyed today's episode and maybe learned something. Please join me again next time when I will share a little bit of my story and explain what it was that led me to embrace being alcohol free. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Debate Podcast, where we set out to separate myth from reality as we explore what alcohol does for us and what it does to us as individuals and as a society, why we love booze and why there are times when we really don't love it at all. If you would like to know more about today's topic, please head for my website, winetowatercoaching.com. where you'll find further information and worksheets for the tips and tactics that I share. That's winetowatercoaching.com, and the two is T-O, winetowatercoaching.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Facebook and LinkedIn. Just search for Wine to Water Coaching. If you've enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcasts. And please do rate it and review it, as it will help other people find the show and get answers to their questions on the truth about booze. And I hope you'll join me again soon for another episode of the Alcohol Debate Podcast.